Hey everybody, Craig here with just a quick announcement before we start the episode, which is that the Legendarium is going away, temporarily, okay? No, we're not going away, but I am going to put the show on a brief hiatus. Essentially, what it comes down to is we just need a little bit of break on the show. I need a little bit of a break on the show. We've been going for 10 years now, which is absolutely amazing, and while we have obviously not been perfect about doing a show every week, especially lately. It's essentially been a weekly show for the last 10 years, and I feel like it would be good for us to take a few months off and recoup and reassess. And like I said before, it's mostly for myself. I've developed quite a lot of anxiety around the show, honestly, producing the show, which is part of why it's been so sporadic. So between that and kind of feeling like qualitatively, the show has kind of stagnated a little bit. I wanted to take a step back, give myself a breather for a few months, and come back when I feel like I can do a better job and be more passionate about it. And, you know, maybe we can make some changes around the edges as far as what type of content we're bringing you. Go back to some of the older stuff that we used to do and mix that in with some of the newer stuff that I've done in the last year or two, you know, author interviews, the author shelf, that sort of thing. So yeah, we're going to take a little bit of time off. I'll still be around on Discord. You know, you're welcome to chat with me there. I'll be around on social media, all that stuff. And there will still be episodes occasionally over the next few months. I know that I need to still publish the final Acts of Cain episode that I've been doing with Drew over on Inking Out Loud. So things like that will occasionally come out, but I'm just not going to try to hold myself to regular releases for a while. So hopefully you guys understand. If you have any further questions, I'll answer what I can over on Discord or on Twitter or wherever. Go ahead and ask away. Anyway, with that being said, let's roll the episode. This is me and Todd talking mostly about the new Dune movie, just kind of for fun. It's me and Todd. We had just recorded the Patreon episode for The Wheel of Time. He's almost done with The Wheel of Time. It's very exciting. You can check that out. And then we just kind of rolled into this discussion of Dune. So enjoy that. Don't go anywhere. Don't delete this off your podcast feed. We'll be back. You know, don't delete your Patreon. You won't be charged for the next few months. So anyway, with that being said, enjoy the episode, and I will see you guys around on Discord and back here on the feed in a few months. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Legendarium Podcast. I'm your host, Craig. Over there, he's Todd.
Yes, hey, I am. Tom. Hey, wait a minute. You didn't insult me. What is going wrong with you?
There's still time. All right. Todd, I have a very simple question for you.
Okay, I'm ready.
Did you see Dune Part 2?
Yes! Oh, my goodness, yes!
How did it go?
I was ticked off at the end.
Really?
I was ticked off at the end.
Okay.
Are spoilers?
Full spoilers ahoy.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, I absolutely jumped. When the first movie ended, I'm speechless.
He can't even
I'm speechless.
Talk.
How often does that happen? Not that often. I jumped in. I felt like we pick up right where we left off. It was beautiful. We started running, and then there were three decisions that Denis Villeneuve made. That I'm sure I said the name.
No, valiant effort.
I tried.
That was excellent.
I tried.
That was very good.
I've been screwing up names all night long.
For those wondering what he's referencing, we just recorded a Wheel of Time
episode,
thing
yeah.
for Patreon. So.
And I sucked. When it comes to, anyway, because it's all at 1.7 speed. Wonder what Dune would have been like at 1.7. Never mind. The first decision was to not have Alia born.
Mm.
And I went, what the hell? Hello? No, you can't do this. This is wrong. This is significantly wrong. It sets up some real problems if we're going to move forward with the series. The second one that really ticked me off was the introduction of this schism among the Fremen of a very religiously fundamentalist conservative group and a very secular, looking down their noses at all of the religious ones. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're the Southern Fremen. They're not as informed. They're all a bunch of religious zealots, not like us. And we put Chani on the side of the skeptics.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is a problem. I felt like it was a, I recognize people have to do creative things and they get their opportunity. But I felt like that was a real disservice to the source material. The last piece that I was frustrated with, that I was ticked off.
And then can we get to the good stuff?
And then we can get to all the good stuff. Okay, I'll get it out of the way. Was that it only took a couple of months. This is all supposed to have happened in just a few months because Aaliyah has not been born yet.
Mm-mm.
And so it's less than a year. And in the book, it's several years. Aaliyah, when she shows up, is about a 3 or 4 year old little girl.
Mm.
So it's, you know, the better part of a decade that has gone on to get Paul to where he is now, because we don't know how, because the settling onto Dune and starting all of the things that House Atreides had to do took some time. It didn't happen in 4 days. And then the rebellion that he helps the Fremen build took some time.
Right. Well, good luck getting, what's his name, Timothy Chalamet, to look like anything other than a 14-year-old kid.
He is such a pretty boy. He really
I'm
is.
I'm just saying, like, if you want the story to take a decade.
Yeah. You have to let him age.
I mean, he apparently can't.
Not really.
So.
I think he has portraits aging for him someplace in his house. So with those caveats, with those three little things, maybe big. With those three things, other than that, oh my gosh, I grinned through the whole thing.
It's definitely, I mean, look, it's a cliche at this point. Everybody who went and saw it and then talked about it on a podcast has said the same thing. Riding the Sandworm was the coolest cinematic experience
ever. Oh, it was awesome. That was awesome. I took my team, my learning and development team, to go see it as part of we have an offsite strategy meeting. And they said, an offsite strategy meeting? I said, shut up. Do you want popcorn or not? And we went and we saw it. And one of the members of my team then took his wife to go see it.
Yeah.
The same week. They have since seen it together 3 times. She has seen it an additional 2.
Oh, man.
He said one time they went and watched it in the D-box seats.
Oh, yeah.
He said that was the most incredible experience he's ever had.
Really?
And I believe it. Mm. I believe it. It is so different from the David Lynch telling.
What? No. No, they're basically the same.
Okay, Craig, I'm going to beat you to death with a microphone right now. I'm very tempted. I like the David Lynch version. I really do. There are lots of things about it that I think were really, really well done. There are deviations in that one too that really annoy me, but I think it was really well done. But this one was just scope and majesty and maybe it's just because we're, what, 30, 40 years down the pipe and we've got better special effects and we can do more. But my goodness.
I'm torn on one thing about it. When you talk about the scope, the majesty, the just the cinematic experience of it.
Okay.
I'm torn between two true things.
Okay.
One, I love the moments when Denis Villeneuve just slows down, gives you a nice vista.
Yeah.
A great Hans Zimmer score.
Yeah.
Just a beautiful image and lets you enjoy that for a while, right?
The
cinematography, unreal. Oh, yeah. Just gorgeous stuff, right? Okay, that is true. Also true, the movie is too damn long. You know, when you watch a movie, Saving Private Ryan would be maybe an example. I'm sure there are a million others where it's like 2.5+ hour movie and you get done with it and you're like, wait, that's how much time went by. I didn't realize it. It just carried me through it without, you know, like, no, I felt every minute of this movie. It felt simultaneously too long and also like, can we just indulge a little more? I don't know how to marry those two things in my mind.
I found one of the things that I liked that happened in this one, and I've already I said my piece about the schism, that the artificial schism that is created, because I don't I've only read the book three times, and you know, maybe I'm remembering it wrong, but I don't remember that schism being a part of it. What I do remember is that there were scenes that were given a lot more screen time than I think they deserved.
Okay. For example,
the scene where they have the conclave of the chiefs in the Southern Siege, and they all have to get behind one leader and all those kinds of things. And I was like,
Well, what? Express your thoughts. Use your words.
It did not feel like it was true to the image that was created by Frank Herbert. If I remember correctly, Paul was not there. All of the rest of the chieftains were there, and he got told about it later. And so
that's not very interesting to watch, though.
You know, David Lynch did that. David Lynch gave him a moment where they came in and they told him,
who cares?
I care.
David Lynch did that to save time.
Maybe, but that scene didn't exist in the source material. So why not, you know, get rid of it? Another one that didn't really exist in the source material. And this is kind of interesting because we get it because of a hint. And that is the big fight that Fade Rautha has in that stadium and for his birthday and all these kinds of things. We get a hint of it. But that one goes on. That's a lot of stuff. Some really interesting cinematography, some really interesting storytelling with, you know, why is it all in black and white and all these different kinds of things. It was some really cool stuff. And that was stuff that I really didn't care about much.
Fair enough. I love Fade Rautha's character in the movie, though. And Austin Butler.
Wonderful job.
Who would have thought Austin Butler would escape, not just unscathed, but like conquering the world after Shannara.
Yeah.
Wow. Has he done a number for his career?
Right? A very big pivot, I would say.
Which it's funny because, I mean, this is another fantasy sci-fi adaptation, but you know.
One is really regarded with some very positive things, and the other exists.
Did you ever watch Shannara?
I did not.
Oh, Todd.
I did not.
Oh, Todd. If
I heard enough about it that I kind of went, yeah, no, I'm not going to waste my time.
Do you get any pleasure from watching bad stuff?
Occasionally,
I do. Occasionally, B movies, or
especially if it features Jackie Chan,
sure,
or Channing Tatum.
obviously, Jackie Channing Tatum.
Jackie Channing Tatum.
Whatever. Yeah. You should watch Shannara. It is just the first season. Everything after that is whatever.
Even worse.
I have never come across an adaptation, or not just an adaptation. Across a scripted piece of media.
Wow.
I want to leave quote unquote reality TV off to the side for a minute. Okay. But I've never seen a scripted show that thinks less of its audience's intellect as Shannara does.
Okay.
It is remarkable.
Even Green Lantern It's worse than Green Lantern.
I never watched it.
Okay, okay. Yeah. I'll tell you what, then obviously I have to watch that, and I'll have to see that. Yeah, I'll have to give you my opinion.
We're gonna have
one offended its audience more? Because I loved Green Lantern comics.
For sure.
I was so looking forward to that, and when it came out, I was kind of like, huh.
Did you ever get around to seeing Deadpool?
I saw Once Upon a Deadpool, and I've seen most of Deadpool through the clips.
The joke was in the trailer. When he says,
oh, yeah,
give me a super suit, don't make it green.
Don't make it green. Yeah, animated. I did see that. That was funny. And I was like, oh, Ryan, I'm so sorry. But I think, you know, anyway, we won't go into that. We're talking about Dune.
This is kind of a mishmash, let's be honest.
I will say that one of the things that I really loved about this adaptation of Dune, better than any, because I also watched I saw the David Lynch version. I saw the sci-fi miniseries adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually one of like five people probably on the planet that owns the entire 4-hour David Lynch version. there's some other things about that are weird, but that's okay. It's the spice. It's got to be the spice. The technology, the way they demonstrated the technology in this one, so fun.
So what, like, which technologies are you thinking of?
Very specifically, the ornithopters.
Mm.
Absolutely awesome. The spice harvesters.
Yeah.
And the way that they worked, much better than what has been offered anywhere else.
Mm.
Up to this point in time, the way that they demonstrated the las guns against shielded ships and that happens.
Are you thinking back to the first movie?
The first Doom movie, part and one? They also did that in
right in part two. As
part
well.
Two in the end, but watching the worms attack shielded ships that were trying to take off with their shields in place, and the worms just kind of goes along. This is just awesome.
I find that there's a lot about these movies, these two Denis Villeneuve Dune movies, that just don't, how should I say this correctly? You don't need to get poetic in describing it. You can just go, whoa, that was awesome.
Yeah.
And that is correct. That is the correct response, right?
Yes.
So I that's how I felt about what's the planet where the Harkonnens Arrakis are from?
Oh, Geaty Prime.
Geaty Prime, right. Well, the stuff on Geaty Prime, I loved that. It was black and white, just to kind of give you a sense of like the weird planet these people live on and the light it has. And it was just, oh, that's awesome. So, you know, you say the scene went on too long, and then that's fair. But I kept going, oh, this is, what a cool choice.
Very cool choices. And we get a different, I remember reading Dune the first time and getting the Beast Raban and Fade, getting some very different signals in the material.
Mm.
From what the David Lynch movie that I had seen before portrayed. I think that this time, the callous disregard for all human life, both actors did a wonderful job of making it not comedic. Mm. It was terrifying. The moment when Fade, to test the sharpness of the blade, slices the neck of one of his retinue.
All right.
With absolute carelessness. Just no indication of human concern whatsoever. And the way that David Bautista portrays his distaste for Fremen being, you know, bugs, cockroaches that have to be squished. Yeah. I mean, all of these kinds of, he didn't say that anywhere in the film. I recognize that, but that was I think they did a much better job of being true to what those characters needed to be. They were much more frightening. They were much more unhinged. And I think that's one of the things that made House Harkonnen versus House Atreides so vicious and so hated.
I love, years ago, I read a book about sociopathy. And okay. And I'm sure that the research has outpaced my knowledge of it at this point, but it was an enjoyable book. Well, enjoyable.
A man
it
who was... calls a book about sociopathy enjoyable.
It was interesting, shall we say. But anyway, one of the takeaways is when they measure levels or rates of sociopathy worldwide, that there's more of it in Western cultures than there is in Eastern cultures, like Asian cultures. And, you know, various theories.
Lots of reasons why.
Abound, yeah, sure. as to why that would be. But you know, and it's not like huge rates. It's not like everybody in the West is sociopathic.
Well, depends on who you talk to.
I guess that's true. But I guess just kind of taking that idea to its logical extreme, could you create a society that kind of breeds for or inculcates in its people sociopathy as a ruling principle? And is that what makes the Harkonnens so terrifying? Is that, like you say, they literally do not care.
Yeah.
You know, life is a game. And they're out to win it.
Yes.
End of story.
And I think that I mean, could that be a surviving thing? I don't know. I hope we never find out. But the other place where we see that, I haven't read all of the Brian Herbert and Kevin Anderson books that are supposed
to precede. You haven't read all 40 of those cash grabs?
48. 49. Did they just publish another one? 50? It seems like that is kind of how it goes. I read six, and then I said, okay, I'm done. I think I got it. I know where we're going.
Yeah.
Anyway, it feels very much like the way that this universe is envisioned is that almost all of the houses are that way.
Mm.
You know, you look at the Sadokar, and in the first movie where they are sacrificing people, crucifying them, slicing open their veins, letting the blood drain down, and then using the blood of these sacrificed individuals to decorate their war suits. I mean, okay, that's a little extreme, but and I understand Prison Planet, blah, 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 all kinds of things. Do whatever you want to do. but it seems very much like the rest of that, the rest of the Landsrad, the rest of the ruling class seem to have that kind of disregard for the rest of civilization. They don't care. As long as the spice flows, we don't care. Doesn't matter what the human cost is, because the only humans that matter are us.
But isn't that kind of class. this is how this adaptation sets up the Atreides house as the good guys?
Yes.
By it's in the first movie.
Yes.
It's that scene when he refuses to just leave and he saves Leto, saves the people on the Sandcrawler,
yes,
whatever it's called.
On the spice mining. Yeah. On the crawler.
Right.
Yeah. That's part of it. There's a sense of that flows through that, and that resonates with the Fremen sense of honor.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating. And I think it's very well portrayed. It's very well, it's not blatantly stated, but it is very beautifully intimated that this is that all the rest are just really evil people,
right?
But the Atreides, they're pretty awesome. And of course, you know, Frank Herbert, when he was writing this, was kind of writing it as a parable about what's going on with with our economy, with the spice being
what was going on in the 60s
and is still going on today. Some could argue.
Well, yeah. Some might.
I won't today, but I will smile politely.
I will say, so
as long as the spice flows.
I now feel... Are you high? You're no, high right now.
I might be high, but I'm not high on a substance unless it's spice.
what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. I now feel free to read Dune.
You really?
I've put it off for a few years now, knowing because there's something about just enjoying the movie and not critiquing it as an adaptation that's nice. It's freeing as I'm watching the movie, and so I wanted to have that experience because I love Denis Villeneuve's other stuff.
I was going to say, is it because he's a French filmmaker? Is that why you now feel like you can do that?
For a French filmmaker, there were surprisingly few nipples in this movie. Okay, so
much to the disappointment of every teenage young man going to the show.
If we're gonna get into complaints, if I learned one thing in living for 2 years in France, it's that if there are no nipples, it's not art. So that's the lesson that I took away about art.
Maybe we better go back and see if we can find at least one so we can call it art. I don't know. Maybe that's a reason to go back and watch the movie again.
No. So I am looking forward to reading the book now and enjoying it that way as well. So if I have two kind of minor complaints about the movie, they don't have anything to do with adaptation. So I've heard a lot of people talk about the violence they did to Chani's character and whatever. But I don't know about all that stuff. Great. Take it or leave it. I don't care. The Paul plot armor got a little annoying in that battle scene where everybody's getting mowed down, right? Everybody's just getting thrashed. And Paul and Chani are just like,
Dancing through life. Yeah.
So didn't love that. It felt inelegant in an otherwise very elegantly told movie, story, whatever. And the other thing was, and this is more not an actual criticism, but in the first movie, we got all the marketing materials and everybody's out doing the late night shows and you get the red carpet premieres and all that stuff. And of course, all the usual people are there, Timothy Chalamet and Rebecca Ferguson. Oh my gosh, how much do I love Rebecca Ferguson? Right?
Oh my goodness.
I am in love and I don't care who knows
all the time.
What's his name from No Country for Old Men?
Josh Brolin. Plays
Stilgar.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And Josh Brolin, whatever.
I did not recognize him.
He's so great. His character is so fun in the movie.
I remember first seeing him in James Bond's.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, he's the same guy? What the hell?
Yeah, he's great.
So good.
So you have all these people show up, and then Zendaya as well. And she's an interesting person to watch on screen. Great. So, boy, is she pretty, right? Okay, great. Sure. Looking forward to seeing her in Dune. And then you get 3 minutes of screen time with Zendaya, right? And so you kind of get that rug pulled out from under you. We've all talked about this with the first one. And then in the second one, I'm getting excited to watch the movie. And, the marketing stuff comes out, the red carpet photos and the social media posts. And I'm going, oh, Anya Taylor-Joy is in this. Oh, I love her. She is so great. And then I think we went from 3 minutes for Zendaya to about
a minute and
four,
a half.
4 seconds for her. So I just felt very insulted,
you know,
as a viewer.
That I read somewhere that there was a choice that he said that somebody said they wanted to make sure that they contracted her for the next film because she'll play a major role in the next film.
Right.
And that part of that was that they wanted to give her a moment here and this was the smartest way they could find to do it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay.
Not good enough for you?
Well,
I've really enjoyed watching her since The Witch.
Yeah.
Did you ever see The Witch? That's I did not. I'm not sure that's a Todd movie.
It probably was not.
Oh. It's top three horror movies of all time.
Yeah, I guarantee I haven't then.
It's amazing. And she's like, she must have been like 14 when she made it, and she's incredible. And she's incredible in everything I've seen her in since. So yeah, I was really looking forward to her. And
this was a movie that, you know, the star power for it is certainly not to be underestimated. When you get Christopher Walken,
as the
Emperor, and it's like, because I'm watching that and I'm going, how did they get him to do that? I thought he was kind of semi-retired and kind of done.
I'm not sure about that casting choice, if I'm being honest.
I'm not sure that it was necessarily the perfect casting choice, but it's a powerful one to bring somebody in. And you're covering decades of star power for all of these characters. You've got these brand new ones, Zendaya and Timothy Chalamet. You've got some people that have been around for a while, and you've got some people that have really seen it all and been around.
Yeah,
and my mom and dad always used to say, a cast of thousands, you know, it really was a cast of thousands, but they all step up and pull their weight and make it a great story. In spite of my complaints, it was a great telling of this story. And I grinned through the whole thing. Just loved. And part of the reason that I loved it so much, I took two people who had never read the books and had, in fact, one of them said, I guess I need to watch the first movie if we're going to go see this, don't I? Yeah. I'm like, it's been out for 2 years. Could you never get around to it? He's like, I'll get it done before we watch it. He said he had to stay up late two nights in a row to watch the thing on Netflix. And he says, I'm really looking forward, or wherever it was. He says, I'm really looking forward to it now. And we go in and we watch it. And as we walk out, he's like, I'm speechless. I think my life is being changed. And I'm like, oh, the Bene Gesserit would be so glad to hear you say that.
Oh, man.
So many things. I do have one final comment.
Okay.
About something that I went home saddened about.
Okay.
And I know other people have said this too, but as soon as I saw it, I went, how the hell are they going to make a second movie if Chani ran off?
Mm.
Because that's not how it happens. And the setup is wrong.
Well, and so I'm going to be interested what you want.
I'm going to be interested to see how they resolve that. I've already thought of, you know, three or four different ways that it can happen. I'm not going to make any predictions. I'm going to wait and see whether or not the one that I'm going to write them down, someplace in a time capsule. And when we go watch it, we'll see if any of my predictions about how they resolve this particular issue come true. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to the next one. I do have a question for you.
Okay.
Have you heard the conversation, or been exposed to the conversation that Paul is not the hero, he's the villain of all of this?
Yeah, because I know where Paul goes.
Yeah,
roughly. You know, I've seen
the You've been here while we've been doing this.
I've seen the delightfully pornographic cover of God Emperor of Dune. So
now that's not Paul.
Well, okay, fine, fair. But I kind of have heard the broad strokes of what's going to happen. And I'm prepared for that in part because, watching baseball at the same time.
I get it.
I'm prepared for that in part because Drew McCaffrey and I are just finishing up the Acts of Cain.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I'm without giving away too much about what goes on in the series, it starts as a very stock standard, well, extremely well done, but kind of stock standard adventure story in book one. And by the time you get to the end of book three, he makes you question, the author, Matt Stover, makes you question, am I reading the protagonist here, or am I reading Darth Vader, or whatever? And so I've kind of had that on my mind with Dune as well, just knowing that it's not so simple.
Yeah, there's a moment in the book that I don't believe it translated into film, in either the David Lynch or in this Villeneuve rendition, where Paul Atreides, Duke Atreides, mm-hmm. invites the Emperor to come to Arrakis. The Emperor doesn't come to Arrakis without an invitation, and in that invitation, he promises safe passage. Mm. Well, as soon as they land, he then orders the Fremen to take them all hostage, take away all of their weapons, put them under close guard, and kill any of them if they so much as make a move to step away from where he is putting them. And the Emperor says, "We were promised safe passage." And
you got it.
And Paul looks at him and says, "You were promised that by Paul Atreides. I am Muad'Dib." And I went, "Holy crap, is he schizophrenic? What's going on? What is it?" That was the last probably 15, 20 pages of the book. And it forever changed for me the way that I saw this question of what are the demands of power and how does one respond to them? And I have always been fascinated about what that does. And the next part of the story, when we get to Children of Dune, mm-hmm. Is where we get some resolution on some of that.
Is Children 2? That's book 2?
I think Children is, if I'm remembering correctly, Children is book 2, Dune Messiah is book 3, then God Emperor of Dune. If okay. I'm remembering well, correctly.
Yeah, somebody will throw a mean comment at us.
I may be misremembering it, and if I am, I apologize.
I thought it was Dune Messiah, number 2.
Maybe it's Dune Messiah, Children of Dune. Oh, yeah, it probably is. Yeah. Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, God Emperor of Dune, Heretics of Dune, Chapter House Dune.
Well, anyway, I'm looking forward to the next installment. I hope he makes lots and lots of them.
I do, too.
Should be good.
I do, too.
All right, man. Thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure.
All right.